Good morning. The Senate Health and Human Services Division Committee will come to order April 16th, and there is quorum. So with that, Senator Lurie, Senate File 1034, we have a list of about 30 testifiers. Again, reminder to everybody here.
I don't have the list.
And those who are going to testify, we're going to limit testimony to 2 to 3 minutes, and I will let you know, I will say time when the 3 minutes are up so you can wrap up. So please help us manage time, and we are going to session at 11, and we will be coming back afterwards.
I'm not sure of the time,
but then we'll be taking amendments after session in our next, after we recess. Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, so yeah, we'll pick up Senate File 1034. I think we'll get right to public testimony so that we have a chance at getting through it, and I will try to help you encourage people to stay within the 2 minutes, you know, maybe three if it's absolutely necessary. And, you know, I mean, we're going to hear some good things about this bill. We're going to hear some difficult things about this bill. I mean, that's what happens when we have a $150 million cut target. And so, you know, again, I'll repeat, I've really tried hard to balance the needs of the state. You know, I don't know. Let's open it up to testimony.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. With that, the first person on the list is Chris Bell from Minnesota Consortium of Citizens with Disability, and I'll call the second one so you're up is Dr. Dave Thorson.
You're good, Chris. Here you go. Here's your chair. You got it.
Thanks.
Do we have a... Is this mine? Please state your name for the record, and whenever you're ready, please proceed and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Chris Bell, and I am here representing the American Council of the Blind of Minnesota. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to improve the quality of life of people who are blind and visually impaired. I wanted to start out this morning just remembering with shock and sadness the terrible events of yesterday at the Boston Marathon, and certainly my heart and thoughts are with those families of people who were killed and with those who were injured and their families. We are at a point in our state where we cannot afford to continue to rob Peter to pay Paul in order to balance our budget. We need to take the opportunity now to raise enough revenues so we can meet needs of our people, and particularly needs that will save us money in the long run. It's not something we typically do, in my view. Let me give you one example of why our costs are going to balloon under MA. The American Community Survey, which is issued by the U.S. Bureau of the Census, recently indicated that 60% of the baby boom generation, of which I'm a member and I suspect many of you are, 60% of us have less than $25,000 in savings, and 30% of us have less than $1,000 in savings. Now think about that. What that means is that for perhaps 90% of the baby boom generation, their need for long-term services and supports, for home and community-based services and supports, are going to fall directly on medical assistance because they have no other assets. And that is going to be a huge hit. So my message today is that we need to spend the money that people need, but to spend it in ways that will lower our costs. One example is the TANF block grant. It's my understanding that for some 27 years, we have paid families of two only $437 a month to live on. I think that's shameful. But it's also terrible economic policy, because we know what extreme poverty does to the development of children. We know what extreme poverty does to their ability to attain what they are capable of attaining in education. We know what extreme poverty does to their employability. We know what it does to their health and what that means for them and for us is that we will be spending far more money in the future, in the coming bienniums, to pay for the costs which we have incurred by not increasing that grant. Likewise, in human services, we have 14,000 beds in adult corporate foster care. An individual who has done a lot of work on Olmstead cases and who is currently an advisor to Judge Frank in the MEDA litigation.
You're okay. Kind of at your 3 minutes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Has said that we're the only state that does that. We can't afford it. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Bell, for your testimony. Dr. Dave Thorson, and after him, Tim Marks. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is David Thorson. I'm a family physician in St. Paul and here today as the board chair of the Minnesota Medical Association. The MMA is a professional association for more than 10,000 physicians and physicians in training throughout Minnesota. And as a person in private practice, a physician-owned practice, I understand the difficult decisions that have to be made with budgets. And I know you have a lot of testimony to hear today, so I will try to be brief. This bill is a big disappointment. It underinvests in medical education and training, which is critically needed to care for our aging population, to replace our retiring health care professionals, and provide access to care for greater numbers of the insured that will come through with the better insurance. It underinvests in public health, which offers the greatest potential for reducing the onset of chronic disease. It underinvests in frozen payment rates, providing an increase for the last 6 months of the next biennium and only for services covered by fee-for-service Medicaid. And buried deep within the numerous pages, it perpetuates the provider tax, which just 2 years ago the governor and a bipartisan legislature promised to repeal. Senator Lurie has said the reason for this language is in the bill is to allow us to have a conversation about the provider tax. For those of you who have been here for a while, I know you can agree with me that there have been lots of conversations about the provider tax, nearly 20 full years of conversations. And in nearly all of those conversations, legislators expressed frustration with the regressive and unfair nature of the provider tax, but were unwilling to jeopardize Minnesota care or forego a rich surplus of funds. Physicians and other healthcare providers have witnessed years and years of fund diversion, hundreds of millions of dollars taken from healthcare access fund to use to shore up the general fund. This bill sadly does more of the same. As a physician, this bill represents a broken promise. The 2011 legislature recognized a unique opportunity provided by the Affordable Care Act to not only expand coverage to more uninsured Minnesotans, but also fundamentally change the coverage for low-income individuals. The ACA tax credits for insurance exchange purchase coverage changes Minnesota care. A basic health plan, if Minnesota should adopt one, would change Minnesota care, and the provider tax deserves to be changed as well. Minnesota physicians have demonstrated and are willing to do their share to ensure coverage to low-income individuals and to support investments in medical education and public health, but we will and cannot do it alone. The time is long overdue for all Minnesotans to support the programs that benefit the health and well-being of all of us. We urge this committee to develop a budget bill that meets our state's critical needs and finances those needs fairly. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Thorson. Tim Marks is next, followed by Troy Taubenheim.
And maybe, Madam Chair, maybe we could bring people up to the committee two at a time so there's not as much of a gap. That sometimes helps. So if Troy Taubenheim could come up as well and be ready to go.
That'd be great. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, Senator Lowry, members of the committee, my name is Tim Marks. And I'm the CEO of Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. Catholic Charities serves about 30 to 35,000 of those most in need in this community, from young kids and prenatal programs to residential treatment to housing homeless families, individuals, and to keeping older adults in their home. And in our 144 years, one of the things that we have learned that is most important to stabilizing a family and stabilizing individuals and helping them achieve their full potential is housing stability. And that's why we are very appreciative of the work and the efforts in this bill to promote housing stability, and particularly as it relates to homeless youth and your investment in the Homeless Youth Act. And Catholic Charities serves about 1,500 homeless youth a year in various programs, including shelter and transitional housing. And we turn away about that same number. So these investments that you're proposing for the Homeless Youth Act are very important, and that's why it's a real priority, and we're working so closely with organizations like Lutheran Social Services and the Wilder Foundation to shine a light on this issue, because it is one that has been underfunded for so many other years. And it's an investment that complements all of the other great investments that are made in this legislation as it relates to health care, as it increases access to daycare and child care, and mental health, and things that are occurring in other committees as it relates to education. All of that works better if you invest in the future of homeless youth and not waste that potential. So we're very appreciative of that. And as the session moves forward, we are very much hopeful that we can work with you not only to enhance the investments in homeless youth, but also in the broader agenda that we are part of the Homes for All Coalition to provide more resources for housing for vulnerable adults and children and families, to work harder at that. As the session proceeds, we would like to continue to work with the committee on those issues. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. Thank you for being here. Mr. Taubenheim? Please state your name for the record.
My name is Troy Taubenheim. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for letting me be here today. My name is Troy Taubenheim. I'm the director of the Metro Minnesota Council on Graduate Medical Education, which is a council of the teaching hospitals in the University of Minnesota working on physician training. I want to say thank you for the committee's work on this bill. And thank you especially for the investment in medical education and research costs, the MERC program. This program is critical for the future health care in our state and is key to addressing our physician shortage. We have calculated estimated shortages in nearly every specialty in the state with an emphasis in primary care. And as well have estimated the significant impact of these shortages in rural and underserved areas of our state. The money in this bill, and every bit more, is critical in ensuring that we have future physicians going into the needs of Minnesota in the future. I want to thank you again and just state that we're anxious to be able to work with you on the language in the bill as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I'll call up Jody Harpstead and Jim Prisbilla. And if you, David Godf, oh, excuse me, David, Debbie Anderson would be next.
Sorry.
I don't think Jim is in the room. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jody Harpstead, CEO of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. I believe this is the third time I've testified to the committee this session. I want to thank you very much for the reversal of the 1.67% cut to waivered services for people with disabilities in Minnesota. That'll be really important for us to continue our work while we redesign those services for the future. So thank you for that and for including the Homeless Youth Act in the proposed omnibus bill. Of course, it remains my deep conviction that no young person in Minnesota should have to sleep under a bridge ever, or squatting in a foreclosed home in Brainerd, or in the bus depot in Rochester, or in parking garage stairwells in Mankato. We've been tracking where young people have been sleeping during this session over the last couple of months. The list is on the back of a handout that we gave you this morning. 2,500 remains the number of homeless youth on any given night in Minnesota. And the number to make a significant difference remains $8 million. So we hope you'll continue to look at that number for the rest of the session. And we're continue to be concerned that the very important housing services and the Homes for All agenda is not yet in the bill. One of my goals during this session, in addition to making sure there were services for homeless youth, was to give homeless youth themselves the opportunity to come here to their state legislature, tell you what their needs are, and have them be listened to. Our young testifiers throughout this session are delighted with where we are so far. What they need now for the rest of the session is a champion who will help these dollars stay in the bill and achieve the $8 million. They know you're busy and have lots of different priorities to have to deal with, but imagine their delight when they see $8 million in the final bill. I know your hearts are in the right place, and now you're doing the math. I get it. I do that every day. Thank you so much for your service to the state of Minnesota. Thank you for listening throughout the session, and blessings on your final deliberations.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Harpstead. Debbie Anderson, please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Anderson. I am the director of the Minnesota Poison Control System located at Hennepin County Medical Center. And as you know, Hennepin County Medical Center contracts with the Minnesota Department of Health to provide statewide poison control services. I am here today to thank you for the Senate's Poison Center appropriation. Poison Center services save lives and reduce unnecessary medical expenses. This appropriation helps support our 24/7 emergency call center operations so all Minnesotans have immediate access to medical care when faced with a poisoning. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is David Godfrey. I'm representing Hennepin County and Hennepin County Medical Center. Hennepin County Medical Center is the state's oldest and largest public safety net hospital. And we'd like to start out by just thanking you for creating the new Minnesota Care program or establishing it in this bill. At HCMC, 86% of our patients after 2014 will either be eligible for the basic health plan or for Medicaid. And with that, in the absence of the basic health plan, we'd see a number of our patients who would be left with high deductible policies, which would increase our uncompensated care that we would expect after 2014. So thank you for that. I'd also like to thank you for additional funding for critical access dental payments, and also thank you for not including the devastating cut that would have taken place under the governor's proposal to the 340B program. As we've testified before, that represents a 35% payment cut to our outpatient pharmacies. We currently are in talks with the department to establish a single statewide rate for the program. Those talks have been very productive. We just had a meeting on Friday. But I think the Senate position recognizes how difficult it is just to, within a matter of a few weeks, establish a rate that everybody is comfortable with and can live with. And I'd like to also just point out we've had a similar issue in the home and community-based services world where the CMS has directed the state to come up with a standardized single rate for those providers, and they've been in negotiations for over 5 years trying to do that. We don't think it'll take that long, but we also don't think we can do it in about 4 to 5 weeks. Finally, I'd just like to express some concerns over the Merck formula, the new proposed Merck formula. We are very appreciative of the new money that has been included in this bill for the Merck program. However, based on initial calculations of the new formula, in HCMC's case, it turns out that we would actually be doing worse with the new money and with the new formula than we would under current law. So we do have concerns about that. It would represent about a $1.4 million loss compared to what the old formula before 2011 provided us. And lest anyone think that we are the biggest beneficiary of those funds. However, when measured on an FTE basis, with the new formula, we'll actually be below the mean in terms of the amount of funds we receive per resident. So with that, thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And I have Joe Kroll and Steve Horsfield are the next two testifiers. If you can both proceed to the table. And
I'm here.
State your name for your record.
My name is Joe Kroll. I am the executive director of the North American Council on Adoptable Children. I've been with the association since 1976, and I have been involved with the adoption assistance program across the country, not just in the state of Minnesota, and have tracked over the years the progress that has made for supporting families who adopt special needs children from the foster care system. I have been working on trying to improve the support for adopted families for a very long time, attached to the piece of paper that I gave you, there was an example. When we started tracking nationwide adoption assistance programs in 1995, the basic rate for Minnesota was 237. The basic rate 18 years later, is 2037. There's a huge gap in the adoption assistance and foster care rates in the state of Minnesota. Right now, the basic rate is about 38% of the foster care rate. I've been involved with the Ventura, the Pawlenty, and now the Dayton administrations in trying to see a way to fix this. As a matter of fact, in the Ventura administration, there was a task force convened, and we worked on a single benefit package. That occurred at the end of the administration and was not looked at until much later, the second term of the Pawlenty administration. Now Governor Dayton is looking at it. I know, based on the budget and the terrible math problem that you're faced in dealing with this, it's worse than anything anybody experienced in ninth grade algebra, to figure out how to balance everything, that the North Star Care program is out of the budget, and there's a 2% increase. I thank you for that, because it's the first time in over 20 years that there's been an increase. However, a 2% increase with frozen foster care rates over time would take 36 years to catch up. That just doesn't work. And I think what we really need to focus on is who the children are. There's a bar chart, which is really kind of hard to read, but there are three colors, and I'll just give you a summary of it. If you look at the bar chart, we know that the children who get adopted easily are younger. And we know that the children who don't get adopted are older. As a matter of fact, if you look at the bar chart, there are 40% of all children in foster care are 14 and up. 30% of those children are waiting to be adopted. Only 4% are adopted. That kind of feeds into the homeless population that a previous speaker was talking about. Some of these young people become part of that homeless statistic. And so I know that Project North Star probably doesn't have a chance here. But part of Project North Star was it was going to go into effect down the road. And I believe in the text of the bill, there is a committee that is being formed. I would hope that that committee be formed this fall, get its work done this fall, because all the data is there, and that a recommendation come in for next legislature so that this can be solved. I'll take the 2% this year, but I think we really need to address the problem and take a very hard look at it, because Minnesota is falling way behind the rest of the country, and only 9% of our children from foster care are adopted by foster parents. That's almost the lowest in the country, and that's just not acceptable, because those children would be best served to stay in the families that know them, not have to find other families for them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Steve Horsfield, and then I have Ideal Abdul. So if you can proceed to the table, please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Horsfield. I'm the Executive Director at Simpson Housing Services, a member organization of the Homes for All campaign. Our agency serves as part of the crisis response system for Minnesotans experiencing homelessness, providing emergency shelter and housing with services to families and individuals who have experienced homelessness. Let me begin by saying thank you for your work to fund the Homeless Youth Act. This is an important step toward protecting Minnesota's youth who are homeless or at risk of being homeless. We need to go further to fund services that will benefit the 800 children and their families staying in Hennepin County shelters tonight as well, and the countless hundreds more across the state living in squalor, cars, and in terrible circumstances. While the numbers and stories can be overwhelming, what's more scary to me is imagining where we would be at without critical programs like shelter and housing with services. With state support and effective tools, we have assisted thousands of Minnesotans find stability and move into permanent housing. For the Minnesotans we serve, housing is healthcare, housing is education support, housing is community building, housing is employment stability. Shelter and housing with services are programs that work. When we couple all of the longer-term, system-wide reforms being implemented, along with housing and services for our most vulnerable populations, we can help position ourselves to ensure these reforms accomplish their goals of reducing costs and improving outcomes. Simpson Housing Services receives transitional housing funding from the state of Minnesota and supports innovations for these funds. Over the last few years, we have been focused on creating services that meet the needs of our very young children in homeless families. These services include building parenting skills, detecting developmental delays, and connecting families with intervention services for those delays. I know that this committee faces an extremely challenging task in allocating funds among many worthwhile programs providing critical services. As you are making those determinations, I am obliged to remind you of the significant long-term impact on investments in housing, improved health, improved education results, and improved employment stability will pay dividends for generations to come. Specifically, our most recent study completed by Wilder shows us that for each $1 spent on supportive housing in 2010, $1.44 was returned to the state in terms of wage gains and cost savings across various programs. On behalf of the families, children, and individuals we serve, I strongly urge this committee to increase investment in shelter and housing with services. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. When I wrote this, I thought Senator Lowry, so I wrote Mr. Chair. I apologize. And members, good morning. Thanks again for the opportunity. My name is Aidil Abdul. I'm an autism mom and advocate for low-income and minority autism families whose faces are often not seen here and voices not heard. I'm here today regarding Governor Dayton's MA autism coverage proposed that was taken out of the final version of S-1034. I wonder what will happen now and how the state of Minnesota DHS will correct its current method of paying ABA providers for skills training through fee-for-service Medicaid, while the same skills training are being denied for managed care, which often low-income families are enrolled into without choice. As you all know, Medicaid is half state and half federal, and per those guidelines, whatever service is provided through DHS and or managed care must be equal and similar. Therefore, Medicaid is Medicaid, regardless of who's managing it, and the state has an obligation to assure the services are the same. Currently, all ABA providers, as some have testified here, provide ABA, but they bill DHS as skills training because our state does not have the authorization from the federal government, CMS, to pay for ABA. Hence, the governor's recommendation and DHS's language into S-1034, which it looks like now it came out. So I suppose my question is, how will this be fixed? Because we either have to pay for it, everybody, or we don't pay for anyone, particularly if it's through Medicaid, which is half state, half federal. And I've put some of the states that have autism-specific Medicaid waivers. If you look on the second page, there are 9 states that have autism-specific Medicaid waivers through CMS, and they all of them have age. Some have 0 to 6, some have 0 to 18, some have 0 to 21. They also all have dollar caps, and they're also called 1915C. What Minnesota wanted to do, it's called 1915I, and I'm a stingy one. 1915I has no limit. I don't think private should get unlimited. I don't think MA should get unlimited. I think it's very difficult to control that. But what CMS in demands office tell me is that if Minnesota is willing to come up with how they will cover the 1915I waiver, which, by the way, no state in the United States has ever been approved for. So we want to keep that in mind. No state in the U.S. has an autism-specific waiver called 1915I. But they, you know, if DHS wants to go for it, who am I to stop them? I suppose I would just ask, how do we make sure that whether it's managed care or fee-for-service, call ABA, call it what it is, not skills training, not camels training, because you get confused when you're low income, right? You don't know skills training is another word for ABA, and that's how disparity happens. And I don't know if DHS is here, but I think what we're doing is illegal because Medicaid is Medicaid is Medicaid. I hope that makes sense. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Radu, Sherry Radu, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Sherry Radu, and thank you, committee, and Senator Lowry. With your permission, I'd like to use my 3 minutes and I have 3 other parents, but we'll stay within our 3 minutes.
Sure.
Okay. Come on up, folks. I just have 2 quick points. One, I would like to press on you that we would urge you to include the governor's initiative money in this bill that was taken out. And also, to impress on you that this committee already passed out the autism mandate bill, and we'd like it brought back into the omnibus bill. And with that, I'll turn it over to my other parents.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Tisha Mehdi. I also want to introduce you to my son, Aiden. Today is a special day for Aiden. This is his second committee hearing this session, as well as his eighth birthday. Thanks. Before I share my statement, though, I'd like to ask him to step outside. Again, I'd like to thank Chairman Lori and the committee members for unanimously passing Senate File 314 last Wednesday evening. Autism is a national health crisis, and whether or not your family is personally impacted by autism, it affects each and every one of us in this room. I'm here today to reiterate how important this bill is and to emphasize that something must be done this legislative session to help the individuals with autism and their families. In respect to time, my testimony in its entirety will be submitted later this afternoon for your review. This past Sunday, our family was featured in an article published in the Star Tribune. For those that saw the article, I think it is important to remind you that ABA is scientifically proven effective treatment used only when deemed medically necessary. For my son, Aiden, we needed the maximum program. After 2 years of trying a lesser program with less hours, Aiden was just as aggressive as ever. We needed the careful planning and close daily supervision to make us be as consistently effective as we needed to be. Only then did we see the light at the end of the tunnel. In the Star Tribune video, you see a relaxed, natural day that would not have been possible 18 months ago. Now we can phase out the hours without losing him back to the aggression. His therapy is monitored every 6 months to ensure progress, and my husband and I are required to participate in weekly training as well as individual therapy sessions with Aiden. The $100,000 year cost mentioned in the article is the worst-case scenario for those individuals severely impacted. Keep in mind the average cost is about $65,000. Finally, I'm appealing to each of you today to help families like mine. We need you to include the autism insurance mandate and the governor's initiative. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I think we have one more parent. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Tony Farah, and I'm a parent of a 7-year-old son who has autism, diagnosed at 2.5, and been nonverbal for about 3.5 years until last December. We got our first word, eat. We're Lebanese. We like to eat. Since then, ABA has been very effective with us. It takes time. It takes a lot of patience, a lot of diligence, and a lot of persistence. Since December, we've added 12 words, and just this past week, I heard dad 3 times, my own, during a therapy overlap that I did. And the more I reinforced, the more I heard it. That's ABA. Today, we're living proof that ABA is effective and it works. It just takes time. I urge you to find the money within your budget to protect autism. Please don't hold these kids hostage, because the earlier these kids get treatment, the better. The number of kids with autism is increasing at an alarming rate. We need your help to include autism mandate and governor's initiatives. I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I have Patrick Ness.
I'm the last one.
Pardon me.
Madam Chair.
Your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brent Brickman. My son, Evan, is 5 years old and has autism. Evan was born in the summer 2007. He was generally achieving his developmental milestones. Evan was speaking to me, stacking blocks, and behaving as you'd expect. Between about 18 and 21 months of age, Evan lost all speech, and he would no longer look at me or his mother. He stopped smiling. He'd rock himself. He'd flap his hands, walk on his toes, and he'd endlessly beat on this drum that we had. His regression was rapid and severe. It was terrifying to see what was happening to him. Everything that we read stressed how important early intervention is. We also learned that Evan's sister, who was born 15 months after Evan, would be 5 to 6 times more likely to have the same diagnosis. In October 2011, Evan resumed speaking. He's able to follow and understand what I'm saying. He's able to make his wishes known. I was hopeful, but I wasn't sure he'd be able to do any of these things. So I realize there are many competing priorities, but I ask you to consider the consequences of not acting. If you don't act, the kids don't disappear. If you don't act, one thing is certain, that many kids would lose their opportunity to benefit greatly from these treatments and live different lives. So please support the autism mandate and the governor's initiative. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we have Patrick Ness and Catherine submit. So please step to the table and state your name for the record and proceed.
Morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Patrick Ness. I'm the Public Policy Director with the Wilder Foundation here in St. Paul. Wilder is a nonprofit health and human service organization that assists thousands of people each year through direct service, research and evaluation, leadership, and community initiatives. I'm here today to thank you for making a major step in the right direction for stability for children through restoration of absent days. On January 1st, we went back, or we receded to 10 absent days for child care assistance and lost the medical exemption. At the Wilder Child Development Center, just down the street here, it's this warm, welcoming place where we do evidence-based practice that really is helping to close the achievement gap. And in this warm, welcoming place, the first thing that you see in the at the welcome desk is a bright red sign that says, if you pass your 10 days, you need to pay by Monday, or you will lose your child care slot. And we have no, as an employer, we have no wiggle room there. We have a mission, but we also have to balance the books. And so families are very stressed. Minimum wage workers who are trying to hold on to their jobs are afraid that they're going to have to stay home, care for their child, lose their minimum wage job, go back on MFIP cash grant, and they don't want that for their families. So we thank you for restoration of the 25 absent days and look forward to working with you in conference committee to also restore the medical exemption for children with chronic illness. Children's mental health, we're very excited about your inclusion of care coordination, case consultation, and other measures in Senator Lori's bill. Children's mental health system is incredibly fragmented. This will help get all the adults on the same page in a child's life. It's absolutely critical. And last week, Wilder and Mixed Blood Theater held a theater production on children's mental health. And after the show, a woman stood up and she shared this story, which was a surprise to us. And she asked me to share today. Hello, I am Sandy Simua, and I'm a proud success story because of Wilder's Children's Mental Health Services. At age 7, I was sexually and physically abused. At age 13, Wilder taught me invaluable mental and emotional coping skills. At age 16, Wilder gave me weekly therapy to combat my PTSD. It's 20 years later. I'm now a survivor who invests in young people precisely because someone invested in me. Thank you for investing in the next generation. I am incredibly thrilled for your investment in the Homeless Youth Act. This committee gets it. I can hear it in your words over the session in our meetings. Thank you for matching your deeds with your words. We have so much further to go, but this is an incredible first step. In closing, I do want to call attention to the long-term supportive services. We would love to see an increase in this program. It is evidence-based, great results, serves long-term homeless families. Wilder received a 50% cut in these services. We had to, when they lost their funding last biennium, we had to reduce from 60 to 38 families. And if we don't get a little extra money to the Hearth Connection, we're looking at further cuts. Thank you to all the members for your hard work. It's really something to watch. And a special thank you to all the staff behind the scenes who work tirelessly. It's been a heavy lift, and we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Catherine Commit, and I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which is a trade association representing 7 nonprofit health plans here in Minnesota. Senator Lori and members of the committee, we appreciate all of the work that you've done to craft the Senate omnibus bill. You had a very difficult task, and I know how hard you worked to limit the pain of meeting your budget target. In particular, we are pleased you included language to implement risk corridors for managed care organizations. We think this will help to provide more structure around the results of the contracts that DHS has with the health plans for state public programs. This is a sensible way to reduce the upside and downside impact of these programs. We are disappointed, however, that the bill includes an increase in the MA surcharge from 0.6% to 1.48%, and we oppose this provision. The impact of this tax affects different health plans differently. In past budget years, staff at DHS has struggled with how to figure out a way to impose an increase in the MA surcharge on HMOs without disproportionate effects on different health plans. It seems that that this can simply not be done in a way that is fair. I would also note that the scope of the MA surcharge is limited, as this proposal does not include county-based purchasing entities who also participate in state public programs. Minnesotans who purchase HMO products in the fully insured market will see an increase of 0.88% in their premiums, while the majority of Minnesotans who get their coverage through government and self-insured employers are once again exempt. This tax increase will be added on top of all of the other premium tax increases that Minnesotans will experience as the changes from the ACA and the exchange are implemented beginning on January 1, 2014. As a result, health plans that sell all or most of their business through an HMO license will be at a competitive disadvantage, as they will have to raise their insurance premiums to cover the new tax when their competitors do not. I also want to note the new annual caps for several of the state public programs and requiring the caps to be in place for 2014 through 2017 that were previously in place only through 2015. Having only just seen this language, we are trying to understand how it will affect the health plan's ability to contract with DHS and how the amounts are arrived at. These are just our initial comments. I'm sure we will have more as we dig deeper into the bill. And as always, we look forward to working with you on this important legislation. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Jessica Webster and Catherine Wagoner. So will you please proceed to the table? State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. And I really want to thank Chair Lori, Senator Lori, and the members of this committee. I'm so grateful after looking at this budget. And I'm talking about the state's Welfare to Work program today, the investments made in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. For so many years, I've been up here asking the legislature not only not to hurt children, low-income children and parents, but to make some modest investments. And there's just been a closed door to us for years. And so this is really the first year that I've seen low-income children really kind of elevated, and that this committee and Senator Lori are looking at the needs of low-income children and looking and saying if we make some modest limited investments up front, this could have a return later. And so specifically, thank you for stopping denying assistance to newborn babies under the family cap. Thank you for the 16% increase in the Minnesota Family Investment Program cash grant increase and an index going forward. Thank you for the earned income disregard in the MFIT program. These are what look like modest investments on paper. They're going to be very meaningful to families. And the last thing I'll say is just that there is a competing proposal that we're seeing moving forward in the House that we hope that we don't see in this body, and that would be to take $20 million from the consolidated fund to do a housing allowance for MFIP families. The housing allowance is not a bad idea. We support that idea in concept. But by taking $20 million from the consolidated fund, you would effectively end emergency assistance. And that's a program that's helped nearly 17,000 families a year in Minnesota. And it's an absolute lifeline to low-income families who have no savings and are facing eviction, a needed car repair, a utility shutoff. It's a really critical program, and we're pleased that we haven't seen that in this body yet, and we really hope that we don't see that in this body moving forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Catherine Wagoner with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless and the Affirmative Options Coalition. I'm going to piggyback a little bit on Jessica Webster's testimony. The Coalition for the Homeless and the Affirmative Options Coalition would like to applaud the committee for some positive policy moves in MFIP. The omnibus bill repeals the family cap, which is amazing, raises the earned income disregard to 50%, and initiates a cost of living adjustment, putting Minnesota on the right path to creating a program that allows families to increase incomes and focus on stability. We know that children in stable families have better educational and health outcomes than children in less stable environments, and these steps you've taken put us in a strong position to improve the outcomes of thousands of Minnesota children. In addition, we much prefer the 16% increase to the MFIP grants and a cost of living adjustment afterward to what the House has proposed. Their proposal would effectively eliminate emergency assistance, a program that helped 16,500 families avert homelessness last year. emergency assistance is really the only discretionary spending in the MFIP consolidated fund. Otherwise, it's county worker salaries. While we definitely support a raise in monthly grant amounts, no question, the House proposal does not raise grants for people who are homeless, and it takes away an essential program that prevents family homelessness. In the Senate version, each and every family using MFIP will get an increase. In the House version, only a select group will see an increase. It does not include people living with family, nor does it increase grants for people in transitional housing. Most importantly, it does not include the most vulnerable, the homeless families. Again, we very much support the repeal of the family cap, increase in earned income disregard, and a proposal of the 16% increase with cost of living adjustments thereafter. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Bruce Nelson and Ron Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Laurie, and members of the division. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We're an association of providers providing supports to people with disabilities in the various disability waiver programs and ICFDD. 3 weeks ago, our members and the thousands of caregivers employed by our members and many more people with disabilities were alarmed, shocked, and frankly quite scared when the targets were announced for this committee. Given that low target, we are deeply grateful to you, Senator Laurie, for what you were able to do for people with disabilities and caregivers. The COLA rate increase is, as you know, long overdue, and it will provide a modest increase for caregivers. We hope in conference committee that can even be enhanced. But, you know, at the very minimum, it's an acknowledgement of the remarkable work that they do, and it will help a little bit in their paycheck. We thank you for buying back the 1.67 cut that would have started us in a hole coming in July. So we appreciate that. We also deeply appreciate your reduction in the provider fee. It's about one half, or is one half, of what the governor proposed. And, you know, keep in mind, our folks are almost 100% paid by Medicaid. So when you charge a fee, it's the same as a cut. We understand the need for oversight and inspections and investigations, but to give our folks money to provide services and then take it away as a fee is detracts from services. There's one article in the bill that no one's talked about, and that's Article 8. It's 245D. 245D will replace 245B as a regulatory oversight. 245B is for people with developmental disabilities. And what it does is it reduces the amount of oversight for people with providers of DD and increases it appropriately for currently unlicensed programs. We appreciate that balance. And the focus, to please keep in mind, as amendments may come this afternoon, the focus of 245D is to change from a more bureaucratic way of regulating by doing checklists and monitoring things that are often irrelevant to a person with a disability, to focus on individual outcomes, on quality, and on competency of staff. It's a major switch and absolutely the right direction. There are a couple items that came into the bill that we think are really contrary to that intent. It's very complicated and difficult to understand. But please keep that in mind this afternoon if and when a couple of amendments come forward. So with that, Senator Laurie, Madam Chair, members of the division, we thank you for what you've done on behalf of people with disabilities in this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Sure. My name is Ron Brand. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And I'll have a few comments on the bill, Madam Chair and Senator Laurie. First of all, just thank you for the creative and really tour de force effort to expand medical assistance and the Minnesota Care and the just the effort to take almost impossible targets and to do many good things. There's lots to like about this bill for our members, and I'll mention some of those, and there'll be a couple areas that I think are where I think we could do some more work. There's a provider rate increase that is important to us. Our members are kind of unique because they provide a mixture of clinical outpatient psychiatry services combined with rehabilitation and long-term care services all within one organization. And so when we rate increases for us, because we provide a high percentage of our clients and patients are people on medical assistance, when rates are low for psychiatry, you're a clinic that serves 10% psychiatry or people on medical assistance or government programs, that has one effect. But if you have 80 or 75%, as many of our members do, it's a real burden. And so the ideas in the bill about identifying critical access providers and trying to target some rate increases to those providers are important. There's a number of provisions in child mental health that are move forward, the clinical consultation, family psychoeducation services, and a series of added services for children's therapeutic supports and services and supports. There may be some little tweaks that we may need to do before we finish this, and you may have heard testimony about that already, but those will be very helpful in rounding out the wraparound services that we need to get the best out of the clinical services that we provide. There's a provision in the bill for improving how the ARMS or the adult rehabilitative services work, and we think that's an important provision. I'm disappointed that it's slated to be implemented in 2016, I think, and I wish we could move that up. I have some ideas about how we might be able to do that, but it is there's a problem in the field right now because that service has been proving to be not viable financially, and providers have been dropping out of the program, and delaying the changes that are envisioned would certainly not be maybe too late for many of those providers. And, of course, many of our providers also provide waiver services, and we thank you for the increases in the COLAs there. In mental health, there cuts can happen in unexpected places. So a year ago, there were changes to how we did the evaluation, the RBRVS system for how they created the reimbursement rates. When you do that, all of a sudden we had psychiatry and many of the therapies that we do all of a sudden take a 10 to 15% cut in the rates. So it looks like it's just a matter of coordinating with Medicare, but in reality it comes out being that it has a targeted impact on mental health. Similar with psychiatry, when we all of a sudden do change how we handle crossover payments from Medicare and Medicaid, it ends up being a cut to psychiatry, which is one of the hardest services to make available for our members. And so in Senate File 1099, there was a proposal to have a targeted rate increase for community mental health centers and psychiatry, in part to offset those phenomena I mentioned. We're disappointed that the schooling grants weren't included in the budget and in the proposal. And we hope that it would be. Just as we go forward, just appreciate the efforts to try to have as robust a benefit set in the health reform proposals as we have. Because when we don't provide it as part of our mainstream programs upstream, what happens is people almost by default fall into disability, and we can avoid that.
Thank you for your testimony. I have next Nancy Selesky and Rich Gurman. Please proceed to the table and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Radke, not Nancy Selesky. However, I am testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Inter-County Association. I would first like to take this opportunity to thank Chair Lori and the members of this committee for its support this session of county efforts in providing chemical dependency treatment services as well as health care for our jail inmates. These are critical investments for counties and represent significant costs, and we just very much appreciate your support in making those investments. I'd also like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on a couple of other issues of importance to counties. The first issue I would like to speak to is to the proposed language implementing the Vulnerable Children and Adults Act formula, the VCAA formula.
And I would just like to state that MICA supports implementation of this formula that does not freeze the formula, but rather ensures that ongoing implementation of this formula accurately reflects the population variations amongst counties and is implemented after public review and input. The second issue I would like to speak to today concerns county costs and investments associated with the implementation of several provisions of the Affordable Care Act passed this year. And I would like to stress that these anticipated costs are really an aggregate impact as opposed to associated to just one bill or portion of a bill, but it really is all of the change that is coming at the state and counties over this next biennium. A few of the factors or the major factors that will be impacting these costs is the expansion of the medical assistance program. And including as part of that are the transfer of cases that are currently being processed at the state as Minnesota Care cases that will be transferred to the counties as medical assistance cases. We're also anticipating additional caseload stemming from eligibility and enrollment policy changes that are coming from the federal law. As well as on top of this, we have the implementation of new computer systems and processes, the system modernization, which is very much supported by counties but does not come without investment at the local level as well. Any one of these factors would be a significant implementation effort for the state and counties alike, but together in this biennium, they represent a significant surge of additional work and investment. Counties received initial estimates on anticipated caseload increases from the department in late February and have been working very closely with the department in collaborating and what some of the assumptions are we can make at this point in time relative to implementation later this year and going into the rest of the biennium. With that information, we are currently estimating a net county impact of about $17.5 million on the counties. And this is our cost after the 50% federal administrative reimbursement. We will be revisiting these numbers or that particular number. We did receive recent information from the state reducing the anticipated number of children coming onto medical assistance. But the numbers we currently have over the biennium reflect an additional caseload growth of an additional 216 enrollees for the counties, added to an existing caseload of approximately 665,000 enrollees. So within a two-year time frame, we're looking at about a 30% increase in enrollees at the county level, along with new policy, new programs, training, a new system that we all need to be trained on in ongoing systems modernization. We have been working very closely with the department on seeking solutions to this and being proactive partners and assessing how do we do this and be successful. And as soon as we had some idea of what some of these impacts are, we have reached out to legislators and to DHS to seek solutions. We are proactively working with the department right now.
Ms. Radke, can you please wrap it up? I think we've taken 4 minutes, and I want to be fair for the rest of the testifiers.
My apologies. I will wrap it up right here. I just wanted to let the committee know that we are working with the department on seeking enhanced federal match for these anticipated costs, as they are largely due to federal timelines and federal requirements. However, in the event that request is denied, do not have any alternative funding source, we are concerned about our ability to provide the necessary customer service and meet our mandated processing times. So with that, again, I just want to express a commitment to that customer service and to being a successful partner, and again, thank this committee for its support in county-delivered human services.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
I'm Rich Gehrman. I'm the Executive Director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota. We are a citizen group. We're an all-volunteer group that advocates for improvements to child protection and foster care programs in the state through best practices, policy improvements, and legislation. We're here today. I'm here on behalf of our volunteers to support the Department of Human Services request for an expansion to the Parent Support Outreach Program, PSOP, it's often known. As far as I'm aware, this is the only prevention dollars for child protection, child abuse and neglect in the state budget. So as such, it's an opportunity to begin to reach out to families much earlier and to children in time to be able to prevent the kind of abuse that, you know, causes brain damage and, you know, developmental delays and other things that you've heard about from groups like NAMI and MiniMinds. I think you've heard a lot about that, but what's interesting and I think new in this particular round of expansion, has been expanded for a number of years, is that the department has committed to evaluate the impact of this program on each family. And I've personally interviewed directors of four of these programs around the state, and that's been one of our recommendations to the department, that they do a more rigorous kind of assessment of whether and how this program is working so that they can improve the services. So we were, of course, very disappointed at the decision to put this modest expansion on the table for a cut. You may know the House has already cut this, so we're encouraging you to keep this in the budget so that it can move forward into the reconciliation process. We were particularly disappointed because this body has, over the last 10 years, continuously cut its contribution to child protection and foster care. I submitted a document that shows those cuts over the years. It's added up to about $22 million, and that's only part. There are also dollars cut from children's mental health and related areas. We are now contributing from the state about 10 or 11% of the cost of these programs, which makes us either the second lowest or the lowest in the country in terms of state support for child protection and foster care programs. So this is a modest step forward. We think that the department's commitment to begin evaluating more rigorously is a chance to encourage them to move in a positive direction on these types of issues. So we are here just to ask you to keep that in the budget so that it can move forward in the overall reconciliation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Barbara Cox and Ron Elwood. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. I'm Barbara Cox from Health Partners, and I recognize that I testified on Friday, but I've got a couple additional pieces of information that I'd like to give the committee. I just want to note by starting with a couple things that make Health Partners unique. First of all, you may not realize that Health Partners is unique amongst health plans and that we are a consumer-governed plan, and that's a very special thing about Health Partners. If you are a member of Health Partners, you can run to serve on our board, and we believe that uniquely allows us to fulfill our mission in serving the community's health needs. Second of all, of course, we are also a provider, and in reviewing the bill over the weekend, we are so grateful to the committee for your help in increasing coverage to Minnesotans and also your work to support safety net programs like 340B, critical access dental, and Medicaid rates. I also want to thank the committee for recognizing the disparate impact of the hospital surcharge and therefore not including it in this proposal. In that vein, however, I want to express our concern about the disparate impact of the HMO surcharge, which greatly disadvantages Health Partners. Health Partners is unique in that I want you to understand that in the full context of this surcharge, Health Partners in the last 12 years has lost money on state public programs 7 out of 12 years. The total cumulative impact of our involvement in state public programs is to lose $5 million. That $5 million in total losses over the last 12 years is in addition to the losses that we incur from the uncompensated care that we provide at our hospitals and in our clinics. Health Partners indeed includes Regents Hospital, which is the second biggest charity care provider in the state. So when you disadvantage Health Partners, it comes on top of the uncompensated care that we provide and the losses that we have already incurred in state public programs. We are very, very cognizant of the challenge facing the committee. We respectfully ask, though, that as this bill move forward, you consider making changes to eliminate this great disparity on Health Partners. I would close by noting that I think that Health Partners goes to what the committee seeks in healthcare. Under Governor Dayton's competitive bidding program, Health Partners was one of the high-quality, low-cost plans chosen to serve every county. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Elwood, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and in recognizing the difficulty that you've had in setting your priorities, I really want to thank you so much for your work on the Minnesota Care Program, especially the reduction in the premiums to increase affordability, which is vital to our clients. I want to thank you so much for your work to fund the MA expansion and the improvement in the EMA programs. Also, want to echo others in thanking you so much for restoring the child care absent day funding. And as we all focus here on school readiness, restoring this funding is absolutely critical to school success. And finally, I want to thank Senator Clausen and the committee for including in this bill the Citizens League provision on that program to disregard the minimal payments for that pilot program as they try to move folks through the system and increase their assets. Asset building is critical for family financial stability and ultimately state economic growth and stability, and that bill properly aligns our policies and not punishes people for succeeding. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Alex Fitzsimmons and Sue Abderholden. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. And I first want to thank the committee and Senator Lori and committee staff for making the well-being of children and the economic security of their families a priority in your budget. I know it wasn't an easy task, and I know with the target that you've been given that it's even more challenging, so thank you. I want to focus briefly on three areas of the budget. First, maternal depression and early childhood, and want to thank for the provisions concerning requiring licensing boards to provide information about maternal depression and its impact on children if unaddressed to their licensees. Secondly, looking at reducing health disparities and information that's provided to women concerning maternal depression. We know that moms who are African American and moms who are Black report much lower rates of receiving that information than moms who are white. Third, looking at adding maternal depression or other serious mental illness to the list of families that home visiting must reach out to. Fourth, adding parenting skills to ARMS, which I know you already heard about today. And then lastly, just adding a definition of maternal depression to our state statutes. And I want to say, too, that there was an article yesterday that actually Sue Abderholden and I talked about yesterday. And there was an article in the Star Tribune that looked at the mother-baby program that opened its doors yesterday at HCMC that looks at these very pieces. And they talked about Dr. Helen Kim, who actually spoke to the policy component of this committee about the importance of addressing maternal depression in early childhood and really applying this two-generation approach. The second area I want to focus on are the improvements to the Minnesota Family Investment Program that impact children and families. Again, repealing the family cap, increasing the cash grant by 16%, though we know it won't be happening until 2015. We wish that it could be moved earlier. And then also looking at the earned income disregard, which increases the exit level. I want to remind the committee of the study that we shared with you before, the Brookings Institution study that looked at the impact that $1,000 of annual income can have during early childhood and how it can impact math and reading scores of children. So we do believe that increasing the income of families through the MFIP program is critical to the well-being of children. And then lastly, concerning MFIP, looking at the child care provision where a child who's under the age of six, who's in a child-only case, who has their primary caregivers receiving SSI for disability related to depression or serious mental illness, that they would have 20 hours of child care available to them each week. We believe that that's critical and really important in reaching out to that specific group of children. And then lastly, there are several other child-focused provisions that we want to share support for, looking at increasing the number of absent days to 25, increasing rates for adoption assistance and relative custody assistance, and then also, as Rich Gehrman spoke to, expanding the parent support outreach program piece up. So last piece I do want to share, too, it seems small, but even in how you entitled Article 3, that you're looking at the safety and development of children, youth, and families. We believe that even just putting it within that framework and connecting how these policies and how these programs impact the development of our children is very important. So, again, thank you. We look forward to continuing to work with you as you move further in this process.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden with NAMI Minnesota. The very first Monday in February, many of you joined us when we had a press conference about how we really needed to change the mental health system, particularly for children, and we introduced 12 bills and really move forward on that. And I just want to thank Senator Lori and members of the committee for following through on that commitment. You did include the bill that would help transition age youth in terms of the case management system. You added mental health family peer specialists, which we think will really add to our workforce development and, frankly, kind of change the nature of children's mental health services. Adding the parenting skills to be covered under ARMS will help parents with mental illnesses. You added in-reach community-based service coordination, family psychoed, mental health clinical care consultation, assessment and care coordination, which is all will be very helpful for our system. You're creating the Mental Health Behavioral Aid 2 certificate program, adding intensive mental health treatment for children in family foster care, studying the CABS program in Willmar to make sure that it is actually meeting the needs of our kids who are the most complex, and doing the pilot provider input study on pediatric services and children's mental health. We appreciate adding daycare for parents who live with a mental illness and are on MFIP and Social Security, and adding mental health first aid training for youth, which we think will be incredibly effective. I also want to add that we appreciate, under Minnesota Care, making sure that applicants or enrollees are eligible while they're awaiting disposition of charges in jail. This will really help with discharge planning into the community. They won't lose their insurance, and, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty, and so you shouldn't lose your insurance just because you're sitting in jail. Appreciate the increased funding for mental health crisis services and adding schizoaffective disorder to case management eligibility. We appreciate the money for Text for Life. I know there's some controversy over whether it's really evidence-based. We really see it as it's just a technology tool, and we think it does really reach out to youth. We appreciate the multiple mental health, dental, or health care appointments on the same day. I think we'll save money on non-emergency medical transportation, and frankly, it makes it easier for people to come back for that treatment. We also appreciate the payment increase for mental health services because they are really underfunded. You know, we are sorry that we didn't get the school-linked money, but you did everything else, and we will continue to push for higher targets. And truly, you know, the days all merged together, but the last time I testified before you, I said I was really disappointed in the targets and really was feeling, frankly, pretty down about it. And I just want to say thank you for making my day.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Brian Rush. And
we have to share that, Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rushy, Joint Religious Legislative Coalition.
Senator Sharon? Oh,
yes, Senator Lori, that has to be copied and shared.
I grabbed.
Thank you.
Sue said she could get us a clean copy, but okay. this was a lot of work, and it really.
It's a nice summary.
Yeah, it's good.
Thank you. Please carry on, and please introduce yourself again for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rushy, Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. And like Sue just said, when we first heard the target, we were distraught and very, very worried and frightened. And just want to thank the chair and the committee for the heavy lifting that you've done to make this work without hurting vulnerable people. And I think it's almost magical the way you've done some of this work. We are particularly happy about what you're doing in the healthcare arena in terms of medical assistance and emergency EMA and just ensuring that going forward we're going to provide healthcare accessibility for so many more people. That was your big lift, and just want to congratulate you on that and hope that you can hold it all the way to the end here. A couple things that we really like about the bill, and then a couple of concerns. Also, in the safety net and child care area, which JRLC has always had an abiding concern for those areas. We're happy to see that you've repealed the family cap. We appreciate that you've taken the governor's proposal on the earned income disregard, which will help increase earnings or household budgets for families on MFIP, and then especially increasing the MFIP grant after, 27 years of neglect. Your willingness to step out on that is much appreciated, and I just want to underline that three times if I can. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Let's not lose that in the final negotiations. In the MFIP and child care areas, very happy to see that you've fixed the 25-day absent day policy, which really was a strain on some families and made the choice between working and not working almost untenable for some folks. So thank you for addressing that. And then the other big thank you is what you've done in the human trafficking victim services area by putting $4 million for the biennium into that important service that we as a people just need to face head on, and appreciate your willingness to do that. Two concerns. I am worried that maybe going forward there will be too much pressure placed on the county's consolidated fund for MFIP, and I think affirmed some earlier testimony that I'm afraid that that may end up reducing emergency assistance, which is a really good policy to have because it can get people over a hump without having them spiral down into a long spell of poverty. So just a concern about that. And then finally, one of these years, I'm not sure the prospects look so bright this year, but we have got to do better by the child care assistance program, basic sliding fee child care for Minnesotans around the state. That was in the Family Economic Security Act that Senator Tomassoni had. There's too many families on the waiting list, and we've got to adjust that, and we haven't done that this year. And that's a disappointment and a concern. But overall, I want to leave with a smile and say thank you for the great work this committee's done.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Please state your name for the record. And
Madam Chair, members, Tom Lehman, representing the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans, and I have a handout, actually two handouts coming around, one that shows the service area of the 42 counties in county-based purchasing, and the other is a copy of my comments, just so you have them. We very much appreciate the challenge that Chair Lori had given his budget target. We also very much appreciate the past support of Senator Lori, Senator Sharon, Senator Rosen, and other members of this division in the Senate as well for county-based purchasing. A couple of specific comments. First, we appreciate the language in Article 1, Section 4 that requires new healthcare delivery system demonstration projects applying for DHS approval to document how other providers in counties, including county-based purchasing plans, will provide services to HCDS patients and to show how they participate in developing the HCDS application. We would ask the committee to support additional language requiring the HCDS to verify that counties, including county-based purchasing plans, support the project and agree to participate. The support and agreement of counties is critical if the HCDS will be relying on county services to improve health and reduce costs for its patients, thereby earning gain-sharing payments from the state. In rural areas, it is especially important that HCDS projects be coordinated with existing county services and that they address local needs, goals, and public health priorities. Second section of concern or that we want to comment on is Article 1, Section 59, which lists requirements for the selection of, quote, participating entities, unquote, and their involvement in MinnesotaCare. And we'd ask your consideration for three added provisions. First, when DHS selects entities to offer health plans through MinnesotaCare, we support limiting the use of managed care competitive price bidding to metropolitan statistical areas. DHS could still follow a competitive procurement process as is used currently for medical assistance today, which takes into account factors beyond price, including local network adequacy, coordination with local services, and alignment with local public health goals. Matchup feels it is important not to use price bidding for rural areas, since rural areas lack a competitive provider environment, and any reduction in provider reimbursement as a result of competitive bidding would prove devastating for the local health system and access to care. Limiting competitive bidding to metro counties will also help prevent a consolidation of health plans that will likely occur when urban health plans use their large surpluses to underbid smaller or local health plans in rural areas. This will help preserve the competition that is necessary to keep future costs down and keep the statewide health plans responsive to local needs and conditions, including rural providers. The second provision we'd like added to this section is language that clarifies that when an individual enrolled in the MinnesotaCare program becomes eligible for medical assistance, the individual's choice of plans is limited to the MA health plans and or county-based purchasing plans approved by DHS through the competitive procurement process to be an MA plan in that individual's county of residence. This language is needed to prevent the competitive procurement process from being inadvertently circumvented by MinnesotaCare-only plans hitchhiking, if you will, into MA through changes in an individual's eligibility status. This is the intention of DHS, and language clarifying this and confirming this was added to the House bill last week. The third provision we'd like to see added to this section is language adding cross-references to existing law to clarify that the role counties currently play in the medical assistance procurement process will also apply to state procurement under the Minnesota Care Program. Finally, matchup agrees with the risk corridor concept in Article 6. We strongly believe such corridors must be developed with consideration to plan solvency, however. Therefore, we ask that the corridor concept be tied to risk-based capital levels. Matchup believes a county-based purchasing plan should not be required to pay back net gains to the state unless its reserves have reached a certain level, which we would define as a multiplier, for example, 450% of risk-based capital. If, for example, a CBP plan has experienced losses for a couple of years, which have brought down its reserves below that defined minimum RBC level, the plan should be allowed to use net gains to add back to its reserves before paying dollars back to the state. Again, I want to be clear, though, however, we support the risk corridor concept, and we look forward to working with you and Senator Lori as that concept moves forward to making sure it's most effective. Again, thank you, Madam Chair and members, for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Mary Jo George from AARP and Matt Tuberin. Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mary Jo George with AARP. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I, too, want to echo many of the comments others have made that we know it was a difficult budget target that you were dealt, and we appreciate all the work you have done in this committee. Let me begin by thanking you for preserving the governor's proposal on Minnesota Care and taking a step further by reducing premiums to make them more affordable. We know this will go a long way in improving access to affordable health care. In addition, we are very supportive of the investments in the nursing homes and the community-based providers, including the 1.6% buyback to the home and community-based services cut. However, as we prepare for the AH wave, we strongly recommend that we need additional investments in both of these areas. To protect our most vulnerable citizens, AARP strongly believes that long-term care providers must be adequately paid, and maintaining adequate funding for staff is equally important. We know that long-term care workers are desperately in need of a wage increase and that they are vital to improving quality. It is for these reasons we would like to work with the committee to see if there is a way that we could encumber some of that funding for specifically for staff wages. AARP would also be interested in seeing more funding directed to improving quality, especially in the area around home and community-based service delivery. Recently, we had released a AARP scorecard with the Commonwealth Fund and the SCAN Foundation that showed that Minnesota has to do significant improvement in this area, including reducing the number of readmissions to hospitals. And we think if we invest some money in this area, we could also see savings in our budget as well. On the positive side, we are very supportive of the increase to staff to the Department of Health to conduct regular surveys of home care providers. We haven't been able to keep up on the surveys in this area. Along with the creation of efforts to create a home and community-based scorecard so that consumers can effectively compare different providers. Finally, AARP supports many of the Reform 2020 initiatives, including the reform of our PCA, the creation of the single point of entry for vulnerable adult reporting, and many of the transition programs for seniors who are going to lose elderly waiver services next year. And finally, in conclusion, as I have testified in previous hearings, we would encourage the committee to support language that would require regular reporting of these changes. We have been working with the department, and I think we have settled on some language that will not be a fiscal note, will not have a fiscal note, and so that's something we'll probably have in the conference as we go forward. But we think it will be really important to know if these reforms, in fact, have kept people in the community rather than placing them in expensive nursing homes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members, I want to thank you for your indulgence as your last testifier on the list today, and I will promise to be respectful of both your time and your patience. My name is Matt Tuberin with the Minnesota AIDS Project, and I want to speak briefly to a very small piece in this budget proposal that has received no discussion previously. So though my comments might not be exciting, they're at least new to the committee today. And I just want to start by thanking you for much of the work that was done this year around expansion of Medicaid, the Minnesota Care. That'll go a long way in increasing health care access for people living with HIV and those at risk for the disease. I wanted to speak briefly to the HIV rebate adjustment, which on your budget tracking spreadsheet is page 9, line 414. And this was presented as a mostly technical proposal, which it mostly is, but I wanted to speak to the small piece that's more than technical. This includes a one-time $2 million reduction in year 2014. And what this is from the last budget passed last biennium, there was a one-time $2 million shift to this program that was due to be paid back in 2014. And this is the AIDS Drug Assistance Program that's a mix of state and federal funds that funds AIDS drug assistance, assistance for AIDS drugs as well as related medical care and other services. When this proposal was first put forward, though not thrilled, we were neutral on the position because the department has assured us that they can absorb this one-time $2 million reduction without cutting services for people living with HIV. The only thing that's happened since then that has given the community some pause and some concern is that we're now living under the federal sequestration budget cuts, which is a direct 5% reduction to these federal ADAP funds. And we are not yet certain how exactly that sequestration cut will play out here in Minnesota, and we believe to have a much firmer understanding in the next month or two. But the compounding, this $2 million reduction compounded with the sequestration cuts does give us some concern that there may actually be reduced services for people living with HIV due to these cuts. We can't say that for certain, and just want to make you aware of the potential possibility of this in the next year or two, and that we may come back and speak with you if that does happen to be an issue going forward. So with that, I thank you for your time and thank you for all your work this session.
Thank you for your testimony. We have one more person listed, Dan Newman. And after that, we'll open it up for the audience. Any other testifiers? Please proceed with your testimony. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Newman. I'm the Executive Director of Sustainable Resources Center. We provide safe, healthy, and energy-efficient home environments across the state of Minnesota. This bill takes a step backwards with respect to childhood lead poisoning prevention and cuts lead poisoning prevention grants by 20%. 1 year ago today, or this month, I should say, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, concluded that there is no safe level of lead for children and that levels we used to think were safe in actuality can cause permanent brain damage. They recommended that any child with more than 5 micrograms per deciliter of blood in their lead should get preventative services to reduce their exposure. That means that 3,300 kids tested positive for lead poisoning in Minnesota last year. That happens every year. This is a 6-fold increase from the previous level because we used to think that blood lead levels below 10 were safe, and now we found out that that's not the case. Last year, Congress also eliminated state funding for lead poisoning prevention programs. That money in Minnesota has been used to make amazing progress on lead poisoning prevention over 15 years through state public health care, health provider, health plan partnerships all over the state of Minnesota. So the surveillance system that has been funded with CDC money that allows us to know where children are getting poisoned, how much lead they have in their body, and how to find them so that we can act and take preventative measures is being eliminated due to federal cuts. This bill proposes to continue that vital monitoring system by taking money out of the lead poisoning prevention grants. Lead poisoning prevention programs across the country have been tremendously well evaluated. They have as good a return on investment as early childhood education does and have impacts on our health and educational disparities. We had hoped to advance healthy homes causes in the legislature this year to help Minnesotans address issues such as mold, asthma triggers, fall hazards, and other unhealthy conditions in their homes. We understand that the committee is unable to do that at this time. However, we did hope to minimally hang on to the dollars that we have to support lead poisoning prevention across the state of Minnesota, and this bill is a step backwards. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. At this time, that concludes the list of the testifiers we had. Senator Lloyd?
Well, Madam Chair, I was somewhat confused by that testimony. I mean, I don't know of any cut in this budget to lead screening. it's true, you know, sequestration is there, but that's at the federal level. We're not in charge of that. There was a Healthy Homes proposal that I wasn't able to fund. I got a $153 million cut target. Maybe MDH is here to ask.
Is there anybody from MDH here?
Senator Lori, Madam Chair, I did confirm, this is Dan Newman again, I did confirm with Jim Koppel that, in fact, that is the effect of the governor's budget proposals that were adopted here. There's a $100,000 transfer in Article 14. From the general fund money, and that's intended to come from the blood poisoning prevention grants. That's what I understand from Deputy Commissioner.
Well, Senator Madam Chair, this is the first anybody's informed me about it, so thank you for that.
Thank you. At this time, we'll open it up for further testimony from the audience. If you would like to testify, please proceed to the table in an orderly fashion here. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Preferred One. You heard Ms. Commit's testimony earlier, and I just want to add briefly to that on behalf of Preferred One. We understand the difficult tasks that you and Chairman Lori have been faced with, but we also want to point out that the HMO surcharge would put Preferred One below its statutory requirements for reserves, and we do not feel that our owners, Fairview and North Memorial, will have capital to push into that plan to make sure that it is above board and able to continue. So we want to point that out to the committee and hope that we can work with you to find a different solution to the raising funds that are needed for this bill. If there are questions, Madam Chair, members, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any other testifiers from the audience?
So do we recess?
Okay. So Senator Lori, I believe we'll recess now. We'll go to session and come back for amendments unless members have questions at this point.
Happy to lay Senate File 1034 on the table.
It will be laid on the table, and we'll be back in this room, so members can leave their items here, but no member of the public can stay in this room. With that, we'll recess until after session. Thank you.